Welcome to the D Word, the UK's only weekly internet radio show that talks dementia, with me, your host, Peter Hill. Good to be back for another D Word here on UK Health Radio, number 328 since we started way back in 2019. This week my guest is Dr. Saskia Savananthan, a neuroscientist who specialises in public health policy and ageing research, as well as being the CEO of the Brainwell Institute in Canada. Saskia will be joining me right after this from Jester Lindell and Frazee Ford. Jesper Lindell and Frazee Ford and Trying to Live My Life Without You, kicking off this week's edition of the D Word, where my guest is Dr. Saskia Savananthan. Saskia, it's great to welcome you as my guest here on the D Word from Toronto over there in Canada, a country which I know well. And we're both on LinkedIn, and I saw a post you put on LinkedIn, and it talks about the lack of energy, drive and determination when it comes to dementia, in contrast to other illnesses. And I thought, wait a minute, that's something we've been talking about on the show for ages. And I really thought, I've got to get Saskia on the show to talk about just that. I mean, it's something that, why is it happening?
Well, you've probably explored it in much more detail with other guests, but I'll tell you what I think it might be. There are a couple of major pieces. I think the first is that obviously there's stigma around dementia. We know this. And that's the case with a lot of health conditions. In fact, I wrote an article a couple of weeks ago because I was at a dinner party with just a bunch of guests, and one of them asked me, what do I do? And I mentioned I do work in dementia. And that part of what we really wanted to be able to achieve in Canada is better coordination of care, kind of like what has been done for cancer. And she stopped me and she said, "Oh, you can't make those two comparisons." And I said, "Why?" She said, "Oh, well, cancer is very different. There's all these treatments for it. People survive cancer, and you don't with dementia. There, you can't compare the two." And that actually, I was annoyed. And I thought, I need to do some digging and look back at the history, because I was fairly sure that that was not the case. And there's this great book, The Emperor of Maladies, that talks about the history of cancer, like from the very, very inception all the way to sort of all the treatment options and things. And it is very clear for a condition like cancer, even 50 years ago, huge stigma around this condition, and people didn't want to talk about it. It was the C word, didn't want to admit it, wouldn't even go in for a diagnosis. And the treatment options were sort of very early stage. I'd say pretty similar to where we are with dementia right now. Like, they're not curative, longevity is pretty limited, but there were some options, and people didn't want to embrace them at the time. And I thought, I think as a humanity, in a sense, we tend to move very quickly away. We figure out one solution and move on to the next. And that actually, there's a lot of lessons there around that stigma that people living with cancer have to deal with. And what really changed was when people living with the disease, when their families spoke out about it, they rallied. And this is, the same with HIV/AIDS, right? With many other mental health conditions. And I think we are now getting to that stage with dementia, where more and more people are feeling more comfortable being able to talk about it, to explain what their path and journeys have been. But so I think that's one very, very big piece. But a second actually came up from a conversation I had last week with Harvey Chinofsky, and he is this wonderful researcher who does a lot of work in palliative care. And he said often, what we like to do with a condition is, if it's your arm that's broken, or you have some issue with your kidney, you can almost disassociate it as it's my kidney or it's my arm. It's not me. You're disassociating from that organ or that body part. But you can't do that with dementia, because dementia is you. It's the self. And that is a very, very hard thing to wrap your head around. And it's an even harder thing often for people who love you to wrap their head around and to understand how to meet the present person versus the image of who they are and what they are. So, I mean, those are some of the things I think that really contribute to why we continue, we have this, and then ageism, right? I mean, it is seen as an older person's condition or disease. And, we as a society generally don't really value the contributions of what a generation of people towards the old, le the second stages of their life can contribute, because everything is so, in a sense, economically driven, that if you are not economically contributing and seen as a drain on the system, then we don't want to deal with it.
Yeah, I think you're spot on in everything you said. I remember, my grandmother was a very Victorian London lady, and when she got together with her friends and the C word was mentioned, 25 years ago or whatever, hush, completely. Nobody wanted to talk about it. And I still feel that, that's the case in terms of dementia. But the other theory that I had is that from fairly young age, particularly here in the UK, when you go and see the doctor, you put medical professionals on a pedestal, and what they tell you, you do. And you very, very rarely actually question what you get back. And I wonder, in terms of dementia, what you were saying about this kind of sea change where carers and people living with dementia are stepping back and they're saying, "Whoa, wait a minute, what about this? What about that?"
Absolutely. And I think again, I'll go back to that vertical, because that did come up as well when I went and looked at the history of cancer. It was eerie how similar it was. Physicians, healthcare professionals wouldn't even disclose sometimes that diagnosis of cancer, because and for their from their sense of what they thought were very valid reasons, like they couldn't offer any options that were viable to the patient, so they just didn't think it was worth disclosing. They didn't want to ruin the relationship with the person that they have built over the years, this health and personal relationship. Families didn't want them to disclose the diagnosis, so they wouldn't disclose it. I mean, if you think about it with dementia, I've heard those many, many times from people who lived with the disease, where the disclosure was delayed or not given at all. And for many of those same reasons. And I think, yes, it is people living with dementia who are now questioning that and saying, no, hold on, I do want to know. And not just I want to know if I have dementia, I want to know what that means. Like, what kind of dementia? What does that mean in terms of my progression and path and what I can expect? Because this has come up as well. We don't treat, well, we did before, cancer is this one thing. It's many, many diseases underneath it. And dementia is no different, right? We've got Alzheimer's, vascular, frontotemporal, all these different kinds. And they have vastly different trajectories. The symptoms are different. The phases that a person might go through are quite different. And if we don't equip the person and the family with that information, and the best person to do that is the healthcare professional, then you're doing it's such a disadvantage, because you cannot plan for or understand when these things are happening, how to be able to support, what supports to access. And this came up in a New York Times article that was published just a couple of days ago, called My Dad's Canary Flew the Cage. And it was a lovely title, and just so beautifully written. The author was reflecting on her dad, who had a form of dementia, and I believe it was a very rare, unusual kind. It was driven by vascular dementia, but it impacted only one part of his hippocampus and not quite the other. And he was constantly trying to leave the house. And so what they were constantly trying to do was keep him in the house and convince him why he needed to stay. And it was only after he passed that they took some of the MRI images to a researcher who's been doing a lot of groundbreaking work in the area. And when she looked at the images and she said, oh, this is the part of his brain that's been impacted, that part of the brain is what is responsible for our spatial and geographic awareness. And the daughter said that, now I understand why dad kept trying to leave. Of course he would. And she felt maybe it could have changed how they addressed that for him and how they could have planned for things for him. And so I think this is another big area that's really missing in our general discourse about dementia and engaging with healthcare professionals. It's not just disclosing the dementia, it's really equipping and helping people understand what it means and what they can do about it, how to understand those different phases. It's not a helpless condition. It's not something where we just throw up our hands and go, oh, well, you're going to die, so why do I bother? Like, we would never do that for any other condition. Why do we think it's appropriate to do this for dementia?
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Jury of One from Mrs. Tom Hanks, Rita Wilson. Plenty of guests lined up over the summer, but there's still plenty of space in our autumn programme. So if you've got a dementia story to tell, do get in contact. You'll find us on social media as Radio TDW, and the email is tdwradio@gmail.com. Back to Saskia now. And, you know, what you were saying, I mean, it's almost still taking things back to basics a little, because the question I still get asked the most, listeners will probably be bored me telling them, is what is the difference between Alzheimer's and dementia?
Yes, yeah. And, absolutely, same thing.
You know, until we kind of bottom that one out, you know, you can't really progress, and it's frustrating from, you know, a number of angles. And also, you know, we've got a mutual friend, Phyllis Fair, great lady is Phyllis. And Phyllis, I mean, with four people like Phyllis, if you go in and get a diagnosis, then sadly it's don't do this, don't do that, you can't do this, you can't do that. And medical professionals still don't tend to look at the, well, actually, you can still do this or you can do that. And, you know, there are people living with dementia that have taught me incredible things. I've got a friend who's taught me AI, more or less, who's living with dementia. So, you know.
Oh, absolutely. I feel this is a wonderful example of that. I think she's lived with dementia for over 10 years and was a very busy emergency room nurse, I believe. And she is astonishing as a person, not as just a person living with dementia, but when you have that layer on. I mean, 2 years ago, she's done a lot of work on human rights and recognizing dementia as a disability and the human rights components to all of that. She traveled to Geneva by herself and testified in front of the United Nations CRPD, the Convention on the Rights of People Living with Dementia, in front of that committee on behalf of Brainwell for us, speaking to her condition, but really speaking to the nitty-gritties of the legal aspects of human rights. This is a person who's been living with dementia for 10 years. And I think taking that strengths-based approach, as you're really saying, is something that we don't do yet, or even thinking about it from a rehabilitative approach. What can we do to continue to enable these pieces, or find a workaround the way we might, like, let's say, okay, your writing skill is changing. Okay, what's a different way to still enable that skill the way we would for other people and other conditions? I think it's easy sometimes to get frustrated, and I do get frustrated and angry. But I do also sometimes take a step back and think, okay, we have been able to solve and fairly reasonably make some progress on some huge conditions that have impacted humankind. It is possible to do this for dementia. We just need to continue to find that path forward and raise that awareness, but really come at it with solutions that can enable the kind of outcomes we want.
And I guess, the world we live in, I know you've been involved at government level. And, I guess things start with a strategy that tells you what you're going to do and where you're going to go. Something that I'll repeat, we are sadly lacking still in the UK, despite being promised it on numerous occasions. But that is only the start of the process, and the strategy sometimes can be dusty documents on dusty shelves that people pat themselves on the back for creating. But surely, the next stage is the action plan and who's going to do what and when.
You're speaking my language. We could go on that for a while. Absolutely. I think it's part of work that we did at the Brainwell Institute. We released a report called Mind the Gap. And this was exactly it. My co-founder, Alexandra Waite, and I, we're both researchers, and we've both worked with people living with dementia and had lived experience of it as well. And we were just done with hearing about, here's another strategy. The system is fractured. We need better care coordination. Okay, and what? What are we doing towards achieving that? It's not going to fix everything right away, but surely there are some smaller steps we could start taking towards that goal. And with these strategies, we looked at countries that had a dementia strategy, but also progressed that strategy, and which ones were successful in doing that. And yes, unfortunately, the UK did not make the list for us because they didn't have, you don't have a strategy. Though I will say there was a lot of inspiration with your previous strategy and quite a bit of galvanized force that came, I think, in 2018. It really got the G7 countries moving, and then a lot of that momentum kind of did peter out. But in that study that we did, we looked at countries that were similar to Canada in that they have a federated system, meaning you've got the central, a federal government that funds most of the things, sets direction and some priorities, but the implementation of care is at the regions or the provincial or health authority levels. And it became very clear that the countries that have really progressed on dementia, and they're the people we already know, countries like the Netherlands, a lot like Sweden, Denmark, Australia, Germany, are countries that took the strategy as inspiration. It sort of helps focus the vision, galvanize, and get people to feel hopeful towards what and inspire them. But then they were quite concrete with going, okay, what are we trying to achieve? What's the goal? How do we make that very specific? How do we measure if we're going to achieve that goal? Because what does success look like? I mean, this is, I think, one of my criticisms of the Canadian strategy, because it's a fantastic strategy. It sets a really valuable vision. And then we get to the point of things like we want good quality of life for people living with dementia. Absolutely, we do. Well, what does that mean? How do we know we're getting to good quality of life? Does that mean, you know, 50% of everyone who's diagnosed knows what their care plan is? Or does that mean that 100% of people who have dementia get the diagnosis? What do we mean? It can mean anything at this point, but let's pick something and work towards it and provide the data to support that and then hold ourselves accountable that way. Who's responsible for what and how do you get that done? And this is, again, part of where we struggle because here we've got the Ministry of Health in provinces that is really accountable for it. But often many provinces have a Ministry of Long-Term Care, a Ministry of Seniors, a Ministry of Housing, Ministry of Transportation. And dementia is a bit devilish because it doesn't just stick to health, does it? It goes across everything. And so then everyone just goes, well, it's not me. It's that guy or this lady over there has to deal with it. No one has the accountability that way. And this is really what we're trying to push with wonderful, inspiring strategy. Now, ultimately, instead of a dusty document, how is this impacting the people that you were voted in to serve? How are we achieving that?
I've been sitting in this prison, counting corners on the wall, thinking how I wonder if you think of me at all. Looking through old pictures I have stored inside my mind of you and me together, once on a happy time. I wish that I could fly away back to your arms tonight. Wake up in the morning with those arms around me tight. I'd love you like I should have all the way from way back then. If I could only fly away and make you mine again. My prison is this barroom, every day from 6 to 2. And as soon as I'm off work, right when happy hour is through, chained here by the freedom that I keep pouring into me. Every time I come back down and face your memory, I wish that I could fly away back to your arms tonight. Wake up in the morning with those arms around me tight. I'd love you like I should have all the way from way back then. If I could only fly away and make you mine again.
I never apologise for playing Willie Nelson on the show. 93 and with a new album out called Dream Chaser, where you can find that one, Fly Away. Back to my chat with Saskia now. We really are on the same page, Saskia, with all of this stuff. And I think one thing we notice here in the UK is that we've got a lot of excellent people in charities doing excellent work, but they're all fragmented. And there isn't anybody who's sitting up there looking down on what these people are doing. Some of them are doing the same thing and don't know about it. In some areas you get it, in other areas you don't. And it was quite interesting because, you know, we've got a lot of contacts. I know you were on the Dementia Connection with Andy Grazer. And when you were on with Andy, you came across an analogy that made me sit there with my mouth open and say, wait a minute, this is absolutely spot on. And you said that the way dementia is managed is a bit like managing flights, okay, without any air traffic control.
Yeah, exactly. I actually have to give kudos to my husband for helping me figure that one out, because I was so mad one day and I was like, this is crazy. Like, we don't, you know, we're duplicating things. We don't know where this gap is. And he said, it's kind of like you're flying with nothing. And I'm like, that's it. It is. A lot of people have a lot of stress around flying, especially internationally, right? We are prepared. We have to, there are all these, you know, checkpoints and things you have to go through. And now imagine no air traffic controllers. You just got planes piling up, taking off when they feel like it, landing when they, wherever they, and whenever they feel like it. I mean, it would never happen. It's impossible. And yet that is very much how we manage older adult care generally. And then very specifically, it's also how we manage dementia. And this is why the effect of it is caregivers who are burning out at extraordinary rates, because they're trying to navigate all of this for themselves. They are the air traffic controllers, except they don't know the system. So how on earth are they supposed to figure out where to go and how to go? A lot of them are taking it on themselves at home and trying to manage as much as they can. Financially, that's a huge cost. And emotionally, it takes its toll, even with the best intentions of you know, someone whom you might really love and have a wonderful relationship with. And we've not even talked about the kinds of relationships where maybe, you know, the person who has dementia is not someone that you got along with. Now, how do you provide care for them? And what does that look like with the lack of a formal system to support?
Yeah, and I think that along with that, particularly, you know, here in the UK, I think you've got the same as well. I think the same all over the world. The whole thing about health and social care, where people seem to think, oh, well, health's over there and social care's over there. And people like me are screaming, well, actually, it's the same thing. You know, we've got people in the hospitals here under the NHS who can't actually be discharged because there isn't a social care provision in the community for them to go to. And it just, you know, all this to me, and it's kind of strange. I think a lot of this stuff's common sense. And then I kind of come off having talked to someone like you or whatever and think, am I really right? Is this common sense or is it just me?
It's change management.
Okay.
And in a sense, it's almost project and programmatic management. And that's what we used for the Mind the Gap report. A lot of the literature we looked at outside of the dementia literature was, what does change management say about how to manage these and how to do this? And other industries do this with very complex systems. I mean, air traffic control is incredibly complex. If we can get that right, then surely we can get the same right here. I do agree, health and social are almost thought of as parallel, separate systems. We have the same issue. In Canada, it's called ALC beds, assisted alternate level of care beds in hospitals, particularly acute care hospitals. And what's happening is that people living with dementia might come in, not necessarily for the dementia, might be for some other condition, but the dementia exasperates it because they've not been able to manage it well. They've hit a crisis point, and now they cannot be discharged safely. And so they are in these hospital beds waiting for days on end before they get discharged, because there is no community care models or approaches. And often our response has been, well, we need to build more long-term care beds. That's not actually, I would push back quite a bit on that. I think, yes, there is sometimes a need for long-term care in very, very complex patients, but the vast majority of people do not want to be in long-term care. And if we have expressly said that that's not what we want, why do we just keep building these beds? You know, I think that's why we're so attracted to these other models of care that come out from other places, things like, you know, the dementia villages or intergenerational care homes or, you know, community living homes, because they are closer to the values that a lot of people now have around how they want to live, especially towards the end stages of their lives. And this also got brought up by someone else when we were talking about this, where we are living longer, but we're not necessarily living healthier. And so quality of life is a very important discussion, but there's quality of life and then there is where you die. And sometimes those two things get conflated. If you've spent the past, you know, 12 months in a place that you're not happy, you know, you're trying to leave all the time, you're not getting good quality of life, and then you die there, that might be a different situation from maybe being in a place where you do have good quality of life, you're engaged in your community, you're supported, and then where you die might be in a hospital or in a palliative care home or wherever it might be, and that might just be the very last few days. That might be okay for a lot of people. But because we don't really have options that support how those things work, we conflate all of it, and like the whole last years of a person's life can have very poor quality of care and quality of life.
Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Yeah, I think the other area, we're running out of time, but the other area we haven't touched upon is also the prevention area. And one thing I spent the time in public health before I started doing all this stuff. And when I started getting involved with dementia, I thought there are so many similarities here. What's good for your heart is good for your brain. We're talking about don't smoke, eat a sensible diet, get exercise. There's so many synergies between diseases like cancer, diabetes, or whatever, and dementia. But to go kind of round in a circle from where we started this discussion doesn't seem to apply in prevention. I've never seen an advert on the TV in terms of prevention.
Right. And I think the evidence is incredibly growing incredibly around it, mainly because of the Lancet studies, of course, that Jill Livingston has led. And I think more and more people are starting to hook onto that idea and understand the concept of brain health, brain ability, prevention, risk reduction. Because sometimes driven by fear, but also because most people want to have a good quality of life as much as they can and manage it as much as they can. I will say that in Canada, they have the National Dementia Strategy did focus quite a bit on risk reduction and prevention. And there was a series of awareness campaigns that started getting people to think about identifying what is good risk reduction strategies. But I do think it also needs to be integrated in many other aspects of life. Like, just putting the onus on the person to figure that out is not enough. Yes, you have some personal responsibility, but we can certainly enable the system to support that. And sometimes it might, there's different models and terms. I'm sure you've heard of social prescribing as one approach that people are using, where if it helps you to hear from your doctor that you need to go for a walk in the park for an hour every day, and they prescribe that to you, fine, then that's what you need. Or just enabling healthier living options that might be free, or just enabling it in a way that's more supportive. Denmark, as an example, actually changed their whole dementia strategy to focus on risk reduction and prevention specifically. So did Japan, in really shifting their approach around that and enabling their systems for better risk reduction. I think the other good big piece around it is, yes, what's good for your heart is good for your brain. But there are also there are things that are really specific to your brain that you can do something about. Like, sleep is one of those pieces that we really have not tackled very well, but has huge impact on your cognitive reserve and therefore how you might, reduce your risk of dementia. And then we talk a lot about cognitive engagement and activity. And I think that's a bit of a difficult term for a lot of people. What I try to say when people ask me about that is, it's about a new skill. So it's not about, I got to play Sudoku every day and that's what keeps my brain healthy. It's great. But what if you went to university and picked up a new course? Or maybe you had always wanted to play the piano and you could never afford the lessons when you were younger. Well, now is a great time to pick that up. Because what you're really doing to give people a visual representation of this is, your brain is made up of millions of connections of neurons that are talking to each other all the time. And what cognitive reserve does, which is really how you reduce your risk of dementia to a large extent, is it allows you to build new pathways to compensate even if your brain gets the disease, so that those pathways will still allow you to access and do all the things that you might have wanted to do, and in a sense, not display the clinical symptoms of dementia. And that was some of the findings from the nun study, which was conducted in the US, right? All of these nuns who donated their brains after they passed away, but were tracked over 10 years, I believe, more than that, 10 to 20 years, with, you know, journals and diaries where they recorded everything they did every day. And what scientists were really surprised to find was, there were some of the nuns who clearly had signs of dementia in their brain. They had plaques and tangles, but clinically never displayed symptoms of dementia, not overtly. I think they might have had some loss, but not the kind of memory loss you would expect given what you were seeing in the brain. And those nuns also were very active cognitively, very engaged in their communities, doing new activities. And they think that is because they built this other reserve part of their brain that allowed them to compensate. And so that's what I often try to share with people, because that is a very hopeful message. And despite anything related to dementia, that is a way to really build your general well-being.
Yeah, that's a terrific message, I think, in terms of looking at those things. And I guess part of it is in personality types. In the fact that I've once been described as a Catherine wheel, in the fact that I spout off new ideas going around the circle every 10 minutes or whatever, some of which are great and some of which are terrible. But that's the way I operate. And I'm always thinking about new things, and how do I do this and how do I do that? And I guess what you're saying is kind of instill a bit of that in everybody.
Yes, exactly. I think so. Routine is good. It can be very healthy. but particularly after retirement, this is where you see a big drop in people not being engaged, not building out their friendship networks and their social networks as much. And sometimes because they've shifted from a work routine to a stay at home and putter around the house routine, you really start pruning your neurons. You're losing those pathways and connectivities, and you need to actively keep them going. So yes, explore new ideas all the time. There's actually a book that a colleague from the Brain Well Institute has written, Larry Chambers, along with two colleagues from the UK, Mir Brown and Charles Alessi, and it's called Brainability. And their whole purpose was to try and describe very practical means for how people can engage and shift their behavior, no matter what your personality is.
Well, that sounds a very good read, and I'll certainly be looking out for that. Saskia, it's been brilliant. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you so much. And hopefully we'll get you back on the show in the future. And let's follow this story of hope and how things hopefully will progress in the future. But for now, anyway, thank you. It's been brilliant. Thanks for being my guest.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks so much to Saskia for a fascinating chat. We'll definitely get her back on the show in the near future. If you want to find out more in the meantime, then head to the website at brainwellinstitute.org. That's all for this week. Thanks to Angela, my production assistant. I'm taking a week off next week, so we'll be running a D Word Revisited from this time last year when my guest was Admiral Nurse Hannah Gardner. Back with a brand new guest in 2 weeks. So until then, thanks for your company and take care now.